Ready? All right, go ahead, Tom.
You want the story of the Truman Mural as I thought of it, I guess.
That's right.
I'll read part of it and tell you some of the rest of it. I wrote a little piece about it. The way it goes is something like this. I said that President Truman's home... The Truman Mural is the outcome of a good deal of research through books, documents, and out in the field. It has a story. The story goes something like this. President Truman's hometown was settled by farmers in the late 20s and the early 30s of the last century. No doubt in the pioneer American way of the time, they were looking for a quiet haven beyond the elbow jostling of crowds. This is not what they got. Independence became, rapidly after its foundation, a jumping off place for the West, a noisy, busy, and somewhat turbulent frontier outfitting station. It mushroomed with blacksmith shops, wagon builders, and wheelwright sheds, stock traders' corrals, general stores, gun shops, grog shops, and makeshift hotels. Milling in the new town streets were hunters, fur trappers of the High Rockies, fur merchants from St. Louis and Eastwick, Indians of adjacent areas, titled adventurers from cultured lands across the sea, soldiers, literary celebrities, Frenchmen, Germans, Mexicans, and above all, profit seekers of every shade and degree of honesty, looking to the Indian trade or further to the Spanish trade of Santa Fe and Chihuahua. When the Oregon country beckoned in the early 1840s, the settlers poured through in one of the greatest migrations in history. For something over three decades, independence funneled through its streets and shops most of the expansionist energy of America, which, accelerated by the Jefferson administration's purchase in 1803 of the vast tracts of Louisiana, began moving gropingly but irresistibly toward the shores of the Pacific Ocean. That independence should exercise a prime function in this movement was inevitable, for whether her founders knew it or not, they had established their town on ancient passings, on ancient trails, rather, over which for centuries buffalo and deer had made their seasonal passings, and over which, also for untold years, the Indians had marched their bartering and their war-making expeditions eastward and westward. Independence was located at a natural takeoff point for the overland routes to the southwest and the west. Farther south, you had the mountains, the Ozarks, the hills there. Farther north, two large expanses of plains, and also the river crossings were easy at this area. In this area, before English-speaking peoples had reached the Mississippi, French and Spanish adventurers and hunters had discovered and used the relatively easy southwestward passages offered by the trail. After the accession of Louisiana, the purchase of Louisiana, American explorers began probing these trails, organized mercantile expeditions to New Mexico, Santa Fe, and Taos, all that was Spanish territory, began passing now and then through or near the site of independence. Coinciding with these exploratory movements, and a chief factor in forwarding the rapid growth of the town and in sustaining its historic functions, came the development of effective steamboating on the Missouri River. Westward travelers, because of this, could move easily to the very head of the plains trails, so much more negotiable than those trails to the eastward. Those trails to the eastward, you remember, went through forests, swamps, and were difficult to get over, especially in bad weather. But with the steamboat, they could start the long part of the trek with fresh animals and sound wagons. So, set up at a strategic conjunction of river and trail, and at a time when American urges westward were reaching to climactic proportions It was given to Independence to play a first and major part in the continental destiny of the United States. What I have just told you is the theme of the mural in the Truman Library. Now I'm going to tell you about the painting itself, the mural painting, Independence and the Opening of the West. That's what we call it, Independence and the Opening of the West. And it has, obviously, from what you heard me say, it has a large theme. It is too large. The theme is too large, in fact, for anything but what we would call generalized treatment in the space available. No specific events of written history are therefore represented, nor any of the specific individuals of that history's record. There are too many of both. In their place are symbolic figures, symbolic happenings, representing a multiplicity of real individuals and real events. For instance, your great-grandfather who went to the high western mountains and ought to be in the picture is not. Neither are his friends Kit Carson and Jim Bridger. In their place is a generalized hunter, trapper, and mountain man who stands for all three. The same goes for the other people and for the other things shown in the picture. In the area about and above the door are the chief opposing elements of the drama. Here are the Plains Indians against the hunter and the trapper, and the French voyageur, and the permanent settler who finally dispossessed the Indians. The prospective settler represented is placed in the important position directly above the door because it was he and she who set the seal of accomplished fact on our continental destiny. Traders, explorers, hunters, and adventurers marked the paths over which destiny took its course, but it was the settler who in the end was most consequential in establishing the United States we now know. All settlers, hunters, trappers, and traders of the West sooner or later came in direct contact with the Indians whose hunting lands they invaded. The Indians adjacent to the door are Pawnees. The Pawnees range from what is now Nebraska to the borders of present-day Oklahoma country. Their chief wealth was in horses, and they were celebrated for their ability to steal them from other Indians as well as from the white folk. Travelers of the Plains trails might well meet them first. They would be likely to appear friendly in the hope of picking up a little coffee or tobacco. And this is indicated by the offer of the pipe to the leader of the settler's train, which is coming to a halt for supper. The whites are suspicious, as they usually were with Indians, whose unpredictable behaviors, volatile temperaments, and ways of thinking they did not understand. Some justification of that suspicion is indicated by the Pawnee warrior in the foreground to the left of the door, who, though probably aware of the peaceful pipe offering, has ideas of his own. The Indians were individualistic and acted more frequently on purely personal initiative than the whites who traversed the prairies. The whites knew the value of disciplined cooperative action. That is one reason why they dispossessed the Indians, even though obstreperous whites frequently enough forgot their group responsibilities. It was these latter who caused most of the Indian troubles, according to Josiah Gregg, the first historian of the Plains, and aside from President Truman, the most distinguished citizen of Independence. The Pawnee in the full plane of the picture, in the front plane of the picture, is equipped and painted for marauding action with ready bow and arrow and the famous Pawnee lasso entwined about his waist. Opposite to him on the right side of the door is the Jim Bridger, Kit Carson, Jim Beckworth type of hunter, trapper, and mountain man who first scouted the pathways of the West. He would not make trouble with the Indians. Normally he gets along with them, but he would be ready as the dropping of his traps and the charging of his gun suggests for any troubles which might arise. He is a dead shot and, like the Indians, inured to physical hardships. He is not merely an adventurer, but is, as we say, in business. He works at his beaver hunting and trapping for a profit, but he usually expends this in a few wild days of hoopla with the whiskey kegs, gambling rings, and acquiescent young Indian squaws assembled by more calculating fur traders from Independence, St. Louis, and eastward, who buy his hard-earned pelts at a fraction of their world market value. He it is who made possible the beaver fortunes of the Astors and other great and respectable notables of the 19th century. He himself is not notably respectable, but is nevertheless one of the stalwarts of our Western destiny. Above him is that other omnipresent actor on our Western trails, the French voyageur, boatman, axeman, mule skinner, and ox driver. Everywhere on the frontier, from Louisiana to Canada, he was the man of hard work, gay song, and perpetual good humor. His name is rarely known to record, but we owe more to him, perhaps, than to his celebrated countryman, Lafayette. In the foreground, to the right of the door, are shown the indispensable workers of an outfitting town such as was Independence. The boy pulling the bellows rope in the blacksmith shop is not paid for his work. He is doing what all country town kids have always liked to do, including the artist. That's me. Beyond these, again to the right, indicating the direction of the trade which first built up the town, is a Mexican gentleman with his, at the moment, refractory riding mule. The oxen, led in back of the wheelwright, may be for sale or be simply on their way to the owner's wagon. In the rear, wagons form a train, the loaded ones moving out toward the prairie. Way back in the distance, showing that the wagons are headed for Oregon, are the famous landmarks of the Oregon Trail, Chimney and Courthouse Rocks in western Nebraska. To the left of the door, back of the Pawnee warrior, a trader displays his wares to a Cheyenne chief who has red fox furs to barter. Near the chief's hand is his rifle, a French flintlock, which has likely come west from New Orleans, its journey furthered perhaps by the introduction of an arrow to the body of its original owner. Back of the trader is the persuasive whiskey keg, likely full of watered alcohol, pepper, and tobacco juice, and back of that a young Cheyenne squaw bringing in more fur to trade. Near her, pack mules are being reloaded for a further westward journey. They are tardy members of the mule train going over the hill. Above and to the left of the Cheyenne chief, a number of his young warriors show off their horsemanship, no doubt stimulated by traders' beverages. Back of them is Fort Bent, a formidable adobe fortress set far out on the Santa Fe Trail along the banks of the Arkansas River in southern Colorado. Back of the fort are the Spanish Peaks, landmarks of the way to Taos and Santa Fe. The lower panels, right and left of the door, show Independence in the late 1840s and the Missouri River landing where arrived most of the goods and peoples which changed Independence from a quiet backwoods settlement to a gateway of destiny.
These are questions asked by me, Milknap Perry, Museum Curator, Harry S. Truman Library, to Thomas Hart Benton in his studio on April 21st, 1964, regarding the mural Independence and the Opening of the West.
Ready?
Tom, could you tell us why you elected to do this particular mural?
Well, I was just completing two panels for the Power Authority of the State of New York on the history, it was a historical mural, story of theme was the discovery of the St. Lawrence River by Jacques Cartier. And I had two panels completed of that thing. There were two panels in it. And they were just about completed here in the studio. And one day, Wayne Grover, archivist of the United States, and you hear them? They're all over here. One day, Wayne Grover, archivist of the United States, and David Lloyd, secretary of the Truman Library Incorporated in Washington, came into my studio to see me, and they saw these panels. And I don't know which one of them said, we ought to have something like that for the Truman Library. I said, I think you ought to. Well, that's the way the thing started. What went on from there, I don't know. But a little later, they came back to me, or rather Mr. David Lloyd did, and said, how much would such a thing cost? And I thought that over and said that I'd give them an answer in the course of time. But I said, first, before we begin thinking about costs, I think we ought to talk to the man who runs the library, for whom the library has been built, see whether he wants a mural there. Well, that was decided that that was a pretty good idea. Well, I don't know really myself what happened between Mr. Grover and Mr. Lloyd and President Truman. But in the course of time, the mural began to be an important factor. The president, at least, was tentatively agreed that something should be done, that a mural would be appropriate for the front room of the library. As I said, I don't know just how. As I said, I don't know just how the decisions were made at the Truman Library, but I had a suspicion at the time that Mr. President Truman had some suspicions about me, about artists in general, as a matter of fact. And I think he had some reason to have these suspicions. Any man who lives in the official life of Washington runs up against certain types of artists there that I believe would engender suspicions about artists in general. Anyhow, I had a feeling that the president had some suspicions about me. And I think that I was justified in that. But I do remember, though, the first time that the president and I got to talking about mural painting in general, and the conversation arose in a very peculiar way. I was at a dinner party at Randall Jesse's, as a matter of fact, and the president was there, and he was sitting next to me. And I told him a story, and the story goes like this. I mentioned at the beginning of this answer to your question that when Mr. Wayne Grover and Mr. David Lloyd came in here, I was just completing a mural for the Power Authority of the State of New York about Jacques Cartier. Well, one of those panels showed Jacques Cartier. And one of the ways in which we mural painters identify individuals and groups of people, if it's possible, we use their flag. And I had at the apex or top of the panel a flag design, but the flag had no insignia on it. The flag that Jacques Cartier would have carried was the flag of Francis I of France, the first great king of France who unified France. I assumed that I would very easily find the insignia when I came around to it. I had some more work to do in Canada about the space that the place was to be held, and I was up there and went over to Quebec, where I'd done some research on the thing and got some of the Quebec people interested in this. They were already interested in the mural, but I got them interested enough at this time to undertake to find me the insignia for the flag, what the decoration on the Francis I flag was. They did some work around Quebec at the universities and were unable to come up with an answer. So the authorities of the Quebec Hydroelectric Company told me not to worry, that they would get it from France. So they sent a letter to the archivist of France and asked him what the flag was. Now, mind you, this picture was all finished except the insignia on the flag. I had to find it. The flag was in place in the correct tonality against the sky, and all the thing was, all that I had yet to do to it was put the decoration on it. The reply came back from France to the authorities in Quebec, very vague and very non-committal. I told this to Mr. Wayne Grover, who was the archivist of the United States, and he says, I'll find this for you easily. So he took it on to write to France. The same vague notions came back. Now, this was a story I told Mr. President Truman, and he got very interested, probably because he is an historian himself. He was interested in my desire to be very accurate, that evidently impressed him. But he said to me, Ambassador Bonnet of France was a good friend of mine during my presidency, and he is at the head of the Sorbonne now. He will have no trouble finding that for you, and I'll write him right away. So he wrote to Ambassador Bonnet, and Ambassador Bonnet sent him back a letter. And again, the replies were vague and noncommittal. Well, I had a friend who was a secretary to Mr. Sulzberger of the New York Times. And I wrote her about it, and I had found out by this time that we didn't go to the archivist of France, but we went to what corresponds to our Maritime Commission. And I told her to get the New York Times behind her, tell Mr. Sulzberger what this was, and send some artist down there to the Maritime Commission who could draw this flag. Well, the New York Times was able to do a little more than the government of Canada and the President of the United States because they got those people to actually working down there, and it just turned out that they did not know for sure what the flag of the first king of France was, and that nobody knew for sure. But that there was, they finally ran down a picture in the Palace of Versailles, at Versailles, in which a scene of Francis I was depicted, and there was a flag there, kind of in folds, so you couldn't tell exactly what it was, but with an insignia on it. And they made a copy of that for me and said that is as near as it's possible to ascertain what the flag of Francis I was. Well, when I got that, I made corresponding folds in the flag that I had up there, and I put what was on there. So I was safe in that. When I told that president, he laughed. But that, I think, relieved any suspicions he had of me, if he had them. Mr. President Truman, I mean. He knew that what I did, that I'd go to work on it, and what I painted there would be what was. What would be historically true. So we get the moving along with that, got up to the point of determining how much it would cost, which was $60,000, and some moves were made, and it looked like they were going to have the money, and we got the contract, and finally, just before we were ready for that, I had finished a clay model of the mural and a study in clay. A relief model, and I took it out to the Truman Library for some kind of a decisive opinion on the nature of the mural, and the president looked at it, and he had with him the English ambassador at the same time, who was fascinated with this model. So we got down to the final stages of just what the thing was going to represent. Now, naturally, the president had his ideas. And they were good ideas. The only trouble is you'd had to have a space about 10 times the size of the space in the Truman Library to be able to encompass his ideas. So we discussed that and talked it, and I finally wrote out the general theme, the way I thought that that thing should be, and the way only way that it could be done practically, the only way we could handle it in a practical sense. Well, there's one thing about the president. When he sees that you've got an idea, he'll listen to it. And if he agrees to it, he won't come back and disagree later. He'll stay with what he said. Well, he took my idea, we signed the contract, and he never kibitzed once during all the course of the Bureau's painting. So that's about the way the story of the thing is. Now, if you want to know what Mr. President was in the president's mind during the moments and days of preparation, you'll have to ask him, because I can't read his mind.
I'm going to turn it on to you.
What's the name?
Tom, who decided upon the subject for the mural? By that we mean the independence theme and the Indians and so forth.
Well, I was just telling you a few moments ago about the president's ideas. Now, the president's ideas, as I said, were good ideas. For instance, one of the things that the president thought should be shown in that mural was the Louisiana Purchase. Well, I objected to that simply because independence was not in existence at the time of the purchase of Louisiana Territory. And furthermore, that it would, to properly depict the Louisiana Purchase, I would need more space than the library had there. So that's the way the thing was built up, was partly with arguments between the president and myself, and between me and David Lloyd, and me and Wayne Grover, and a lot of other people. I talked about this thing with lots of people, and once I got to thinking about it. So a theme of that sort just slowly develops, slowly builds up. You want to remember that in a mural painting, you have not only the problem of the subject, but you have the problem of getting the subject in the space. So you can't have a subject which is so vast that you'd have to make every figure anything about the size of a pen in order to handle the subject. You've got to limit the subject to the space that you've got. Well, I think I made that clear to the president. I'm sure I made it clear to David Lloyd and Wayne Grover. And as I said a few moments ago, I finally got to the place where I simply wrote out what I thought would be the best way to handle this subject. First, we had decided, somehow or other, I don't know how we decided, we hadn't. It was decided that independence would be part of the theme. I don't know when we first started deciding that, but that was at the very beginning. Then it was after that, how are you going to handle it? And how is it? Of course, having the Louisiana Purchase in there was one of the ways of accounting for the existence of independence. But it in itself is such a great theme that I didn't see how it could be handled. So that's the way it was. It just built up little by little. And then finally, as I said a moment ago, I wrote my conception of the thing out in detail and gave it to the president for his consideration. He kept it quite a long time. But we finally did, as I said, I've almost forgotten how we did it, but we had meetings and got get-togethers once in a while, and we talk about this, and finally the theme as it now rests was agreed upon, and I set to work designing the thing.
Were you previously acquainted with the president or Dr. Grover or Dave Lloyd?
I had met the president once. You know, I lived in New York for 24 years. And when I came back to Missouri, the time I came back was just the time when the president went to Washington as senator. So I never really got acquainted with him. And I had met him once in Washington in a perfunctory sort of a way. But I'd never talked with him and never got close to him until this mural started. I got to know him pretty well during the course of doing this mural, and I got to be a very good friend of his, I think. I know. And we have, through the discussions of the murals, I guess we sort of learned to know each other. Anyhow, he likes me and I like him.
Did you know Dr. Grover or David Lloyd?
I didn't know either one of them before they came in here that day to see this painting for the New York Power Authority about Jack Scutcheon. That's the first time I had met either one of them that I remember.
Tom, in all, approximately how long did it take you and from the preliminary studies to the final completion to do this?
Well, the whole thing took me nearly 2 years. But the research on that thing took a very considerable amount of time. I had to go about over this country, find those Indians, find the costumes, the right beadwork on the moccasins. This is all in addition to the reading that I did. Matter of fact, I didn't have to do too much reading because I was already pretty familiar with the subject. I hardly had to go out of my own library to get the literary material. Some I did, but not very much. Most of it I had it at hand. Remember, I'd done some history on Missouri before, and Independence, I'd seen, looked into that. So that part of it wasn't so bad, but running down these Indians and the costumes they wore and the guns, the right bow and arrow for the right Indian, the right hunting bag, all this stuff just took time. And then the organization of the mural, I guess I spent about over a year just designing the picture. Working it out, working out the patterns of the three-dimensional forms, and this is where the most of the work goes. Actually, if you'll remember that I only spent about 5 months out the library actually painting, and even then, it being winter time, I wasn't out there about half the time. So I'd say I didn't spend more than 3.5 to 4 months painting the mural. The time, most of the time in murals like I do, goes into the preparatory work. The painting comes, as you remember, pretty easy and pretty fast once you know what you're going to do. But it's finding out what you're going to do that takes the time. And it's this organization of the mural that's the really crucial thing. It's the preliminary organization so that when you get up there and start to work on the scaffolding, you're not changing your mind all the time.
Well, you've answered partially the next question I had, but maybe you might be able to give us a little bit more detail some of the places you traveled to find the Indians and to do some of your sketches.
Well, nearly all of my Indians, as a matter of fact, were found in Indian Territory, Oklahoma. It was Indian Territory when I was a kid. I always keep thinking of it as that. Found most of it in Oklahoma, and I had an artist friend who knows the Indians pretty well, an Oklahoman, I had a friend in Oklahoma, an artist, Charles Wilson, and he drove me around and got me my introductions to the various Indians, and also I was helped by Brummett Echohawk, who is a Pawnee Indian. He got me the Pawnees up in the Pawnee country, and other people helped around there, and I finally managed to get the right Indians, and we ran the costumes down in various museums, making sure that they were accurate that the right costume would be on the right Indian. And nearly all of that was done in Oklahoma, though I did go to Colorado and to New York City, the Indian Museum there. So all this was some traveling. And then, of course, I traveled out to the mountains on the southern side to the Spanish Peaks and made drawings there. And I went up into northern Nebraska, northwestern Nebraska, to draw the Chimney Rock and the Courthouse Rock up there. I also made studies of the plant life of the plains and the kind of vegetation that you'd have both on the plains and right here in our area. I didn't have to do too much on that because I had a lot of that. but it had to be translated into the form of the mural. So that's where all the time goes on these things, getting it ready.
Tom, why did you decide on using the acrylic polymer latex medium for this particular mural?
The polymer tempera, as we call that, has an exceedingly tough film. And I have had the experience with some of my murals and people wanting to scratch their names on them and to experiment to see if they can get the paint off. I don't know why people like to do that, but we've had that trouble down in the State House in Missouri and also in New York. So I knew that this polymer, vinylite rosin, formed a very tough film, film that wouldn't be easily scratched or easily damaged. So I decided that I would paint the Truman mural in that. I made a few experiments with it and found that it was workable. And it has another value, that it never changes color. Oxidation is immediate and there's no change of color, no darkening of the color during the processes of oxidation. And that plus the very tough film made me decide to do it that way. Now, the egg tempera, in which I painted most of my murals, is also very permanent, but it has a fragile kind of a film, easily scratched. And so I think that this acrylic rosin paint, the polymer tempers, is going to be a very fine medium for murals for that reason, that it's just so tough people can't do anything to it.
Is this the first time it's ever been used to the scale that you've used it?
So far as I know, yes. This is the first large thing that's been done with it. I did a few experimental small things, as I said, before I attempted it on the large scale. But I find it a very effective medium for mural painting.
Is it easy to work with, or is it a difficult?
Well, it depends. For me, it was easy because I'm an old tempera painter. That is, it works very similar to egg tempera or casing or any of the other water mediums. This acrylic rosin, you know, is soluble in water when you're using it, but after it dries, it's not soluble in water, and you can wash it. It has odd properties in that respect.
If you make an error, it's very difficult to overpaint, though, isn't it?
Why, no. I don't make errors when I get on a mural in the first place because, as I said before, I plan it down to the last inch. Mm-hmm. Everything is planned beforehand, and I don't give myself any leeway for errors. However, with a rough sandpaper, you could get it off.
Tom, why did you decide, or do you do this with all your murals, execute it after the linen was applied on the wall rather than in sections in the studio?
Well, I didn't have room in this studio, my studio here in Kansas City, to paint those panels for the Truman mural. And there is one thing, too. It's always better to do them in place if you can. It's less work. For this reason, if you're painting way up on a scaffold and the thing is in place, you can paint very, very roughly, and when you get down, it looks all right. If you've got it right smack in the studio in front of you, you're allowed to polish it up unnecessarily, and you waste a lot of time.
What? Is it coming through on?
It's coming through. I didn't want to get that big call in there.
Oh. Could you tell us briefly what the steps were that you went through in executing this mural?
You mean the actual painting steps?
Well, including the sculpture. Beginning with your sculptor and roughly just the major steps that you took in planning and then executing.
Well, the first thing that I did after when I began to think about it was to simply make drawings, tentatively playing with the mural. In fact, one of the drawings I was going to put President Truman in. And then I found out from him that he didn't want to be represented. He didn't believe that living men ought to be, memorialized in painting or sculptures, although it's been done of him just the same. However, I was kind of glad to get out of that because I had the general idea that in my head in the beginning it was better to keep portraits out of that mural because there would be a lot of people in Independence who had ancestors living at that time, and every one of them would want to get their ancestor face in that mural, and pretty soon we'd just have a row of portraits. We wouldn't have a mural at all. So when the president refused to be in it, I was quite happy because that gave me an excuse not to put anybody else in. any other individual, I mean. You see, what I used were symbolic types here. I did use models, of course, but I made no effort to make portraits of them. And if there's a likeness in there, it's the likeness is just an accident. The guy is dressed up in a costume and is not actually playing his own part. He's like an actor playing some other part.
And then after you did the first sketches, then what was the next step?
Well, the first sketches would give me, see, first I did the reading, and I knew, I began to get ideas in my head. But I didn't begin to really start serious designing until the president and I had finally agreed. I just made the roughest kind of tentative sketches. I don't think I showed them to anybody. Certainly I didn't show them to the president. Most of them were destroyed because they were highly tentative things. But that took quite a good deal of time because I had to find out how to get over the door that was there with a design, you know, how to organize it so that I could carry it over the door and it would all be one picture just the same. And that took a little time. So little by little, it was like the theme of the mural. The form of the mural also grew slowly. By the time I had a design well in mind, I began modeling in clay, testing it out three-dimensionally. And I made actually two models of the Truman mural. And the first one didn't quite go, and I kept shifting and changing it, and I finally started it all over. So I worked quite a long time working out the three-dimensional patterns of the mural. Then after I was sure of what I was going to do, I mean, I had the knew what figures were going to be where, then I started the searching for the individual Indians. In the cases of the Indians, I have actual portraits of Indians in there. But I began to hunt for the costumes and the types that would fill these spaces, the kind of people that would seem right for the spaces that I had designed and for the meaning of the mural. Again, you see, this is just a very slow growth, and it's kind of hard to explain it or make it very clear. Because you'd be changing your mind, go back and do a thing all over again. But in the course of time, the form of the mural was realized just as the theme of the mural was realized by trial and error. Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of interest in the three-dimensional model that you do of your paintings and of this mural. Could you tell us, Tom, what you gain by using these?
Oh, why do I make those models?
Yes.
Well, I can explain it to you a little this way. It takes a concept and makes it real. You have a concept in your mind, a three-dimensional concept. Now, I can geometrically design a picture. I can make a three-dimensional design geometrically by the use of geometrical figures and overlap them one with another. But that's an abstraction, and to make those abstractions real, I turn them into the model. It's a little bit like this. When you paint a still life, say you have a bunch of tulips in a bowl of fruit or something like that, you have it in front of you, and you have a real reference, a positive reference, as you might say. So you paint much more easier than if you're just making things up in your head all the time or trying to find out in your head what you're going to do. Well, when I make one of those models, I put a whole major historical scene in the same position, one might say, that one puts a still life. I have a reference which is real. The model is in actual three dimensions, though the scale is very light. Say, maybe a quarter of an inch would represent 40 or 50 feet, but still, the reference is there. It is actually something out in space. And so that gives me the reference and gives me the sense of three dimension and gives me the total form of the mural in its three dimensions. It's all there. Does that explain that? I mean, it gives me the sense of a three-dimensional
yes.
world.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, this is an imaginative picture. And unless I have some way of making those imaginations real with my realistic tendencies, I don't have anything to work from.
Yes. Have you always used the models?
I have used those models since around 1919. I was aware, even before that, that they were used by Renaissance painters. But it had never occurred to me to use them. But in 1919, coming out of the Navy after the First World War, I gave up the idea of a more abstract studio art and went back to the idea of producing realistic histories and paintings of the real world. But histories have to be imagined. And there it occurred to me, in thinking about them, that the Renaissance painters also painted histories. And one of the ways they did it and made them so real was making these models, which produced that reality. Well, I began trying it. And after some experiment, I learned how to do it. I'd played with sculpture before, but I'd never made these kind of relief models of this sort. But I, in the course of time, again by trial and error, I learned how to make those things effectively and to make them fast.
Do you use them when you do other paintings now? Besides,
why, yes. Any complicated organization, I am likely to make a model of some sort for. Naturally, if I'm painting just the portrait or just the still life, I don't make a model for that. Any complicated form, I feel better at ease with the form if I make a model for it.
Do you try to get on your model the colors that you would like to use in the finished painting?
I use the model. Now, that I began rather lately. And as a matter of fact, after I came out to Missouri. I didn't originally paint these models at all, but I found that I could experiment with the color on them. By painting the model, I could put red here and green there, blue there, and try it out there, and then if I didn't like it, I could change it, and that way I could organize the thing in terms of its color, too. That was also a thing that just grew up by trial and error. I did start painting them first in black and white, and I made a model for the big mural I did for the state of Indiana, and I painted that in black and white. That was the first one I think I painted at all. Just to get the tonalities, and then made up the colors and went along. And then afterwards I thought, well, let's try painting them with color. And since then I've done that. Not always, but sometimes.
Do you ever save any of these models?
Why, only lately have I found out that people are interested in them. For me, they were just part of the process of painting, and I always destroyed them when I got through with them. I generally didn't pack them very tightly. But one of the Jacques Cartier things was Franklin Murphy, who was chancellor of the University of Kansas at the time, saw that here and said they had a sculptor at the university there who could cast that. And if I would give the university one, that he would have three casts made. So they did, and it turned out to be a very interesting bronze cast, so that when I made the Truman Library sculpture, I packed it tight enough so it would stand up. Generally, I'd make them so fast they wouldn't last very long anyhow, but this one I packed tight so it would last. And when I say packed tight, I packed the clay tight and put the armatures in the little figures and so forth to keep them standing up. And that one we were going to cast, but I had an unfortunate experience with that. A young man came here and represented to me that he was expert at this kind of business, and he came with some of his kids and little kids and his wife, and my wife was sort of attracted to these kids, and the young man was very plausible, and so I gave him the job of making a wax mold and of casting this thing in bronze, and I gave him a couple of $1,000 to help him along. Well, unfortunately, he wasn't competent. He not only couldn't bring the wax out of it, but he ruined the model in the meanwhile, so we just lost everything. And I not only lost that, but I had three replicas of that sold at $12,000 a piece, so I lost considerable money on that deal.
It's beyond repair, then.
Utterly beyond repair. I don't know how he could have wrecked it so bad, but...
Well, that's a shame.
He's just one of these young men that, you know, young men often think they can do things they can't, but he was plausible, and I thought he could, so, well, I don't know. That was a rather costly lesson for me, but still, I guess I've learned something.
There has been a great deal of interest in that model, as you may know.
Yeah, we still have some pretty good photographs of it, I think. But it's a shame to have lost that, because that's the only one I really ever made so it would last.
That's ironic. I know that you must have made 150 sketches and drawings and so forth, one way or the other. What are your future plans for that large collection of material? Some of them are certainly artistic interest. Some will be of rather historic interest.
Well, I haven't made up my mind yet. That stuff, I do believe that we're going to try to keep it together. And maybe if it's to my benefit sometime, Truman Library might get it if they wanted it. The Missouri Historical Society or something like that. I don't know.
I think I'd go on record by saying the Truman Library would accept it.
Yes, well, something of that sort. I'd like to get some kind of a tax break on it.
Mm-hmm.
If I could, we'll see what develops there. People are interested in that. In those sketches, when I had my exhibition here in Kansas City and in Arizona and other places, one of the most interesting items in the exhibition were those Truman Library preparatory sketches, drawings, and so forth. The people didn't realize how much work it took to get the mural, to make the mural.
What, Tom, was the difference between the colors in the predella and the color that you used in the mural? I mean by that the tone and the depth of the colors.
Well, originally, I was going to carry the predellas, the predellae, along right with the mural. But as I got to working with the paint and with the polymer paint and saw the extreme brilliance of the paint, I figured that as we got down towards the bottom of it, and as these predellae were entirely different scale from the rest of the mural and did not belong in the same perspective scheme, but were totally separate pictures, that it would be better to reduce their tone. So I decided that I went out to the Truman Library and I made a study in paint of the colors in the marble which surrounds the mural. So I painted the predellae in the color of that marble, so as to make it more or less tie it rather to the building rather than to the mural itself, to the main mural. And I think I made a good choice there. At first, I was going to paint it just in black and white, which would have totally separated, and then I figured that was too much of a separation, so I made it like the marble.
Is this an idea that some of the classical...
Yes, it's not... very few of my ideas are original ideas. In fact, to have original ideas in the arts, it's just practically impossible. Somebody's always had it before. Yes, these predellae were frequently painted in other tonalities in the painting, quite frequently and just in black and white, two tones.
Do you intend to do any more murals?
Well, I have said and made the statement that I would not do any more, and since the Truman mural, I have had... request for people have tried to engage my interest in murals, but so far I've turned them down. The reason is simply that big work of climbing up and down ladders, scaffolding all day long, it was kind of tough. And if you remember, I developed a bursitic problem with the Truman mural that took me a lot of drugs and a lot of time to get over. And I didn't want to risk that anymore. That's the real reason why I said I wouldn't do any more murals. But of course, I've gotten rid of all that stuff and feel just as good as ever now. But I still am not likely to go into a mural, doing a mural, unless somebody pays me a hell of a lot of money.
Hold it there.
All right.
Yeah, I'll put it
there. Tom, what do you consider the artistic expression that's contained in a mural that is opposed to other types of painting that you may execute?
That's a kind of a difficult question, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, there is a difference between a mural and what we call an easel painting. generally a mural theme. The subject matter is what we might say is generally more complicated subject matter. That is, it covers more than one thing. And for that reason, where you have a great deal of material, subject material, such as you would have in the mural, there becomes a problem, which is different from an easel painting, of getting that material spaced in such a way that your eye can follow it over large spaces. You don't generally see a mural all at once, or you may see it all at once, but you're likely to exploit it by looking at one part and following it along. So you have to design a mural knowing that the eye is going to be moving all the time over these spaces, and you have to arrange it so that the eye will follow certain lines, and still so that you will have a sense of unity when you get through with it. Now, an ordinary small painting can be seen at one crack of the eye, you might say. You can grasp it at one moment. But with a mural, you can't generally do that. If it's of any scale at all, any size at all, your eye has to explore it before you know it. So the very problem of organization is different from that of a painting. Now, as I said just a moment ago, there is the subject matter, which is probably has more diversity than you're likely to find in most easel paintings. Diverse elements come into the mural, and you have to so arrange it that these diverse elements may be united, not only in terms of their subject matter, but in terms of the form of the mural. And that's the main problem in painting a mural.
Is the mural an early and old form of art?
I would say the mural painting is probably the oldest form of art. It goes back to the caveman anyhow. In the caves of France and Spain, you find mural paintings on the walls of these caves, which are at least 20,000 years old. So it's a pretty old art.
Having viewed the reproductions of some of these cavemen endeavors, that we have improved upon them in many respects in what they were trying to do?
Well, that's hard to say, because we do not know just what use those murals were put to. They were probably made there for religious purposes. Actually, they can't be seen except through artificial light. They probably were painted with artificial light. They were painted in not where people live, but in the depths of caves, where they probably went for some magical and where they were made probably for some magical or religious purpose. Now, technically, nobody's ever painted animals any better than those men 20,000 years ago. So that's one of the reasons I have always said that when you're talking about progress, let's don't talk about the arts, because it seems to have been as good in the beginning as it's ever been. Now, organizationally, many murals are, including my own, are an improvement on those of the cavemen. But so far as the handling of special details are concerned, they've done as well as anybody has ever done, especially in the painting of animals.
You mentioned the painting of the animals by these cavemen. How would you characterize their animals?
I don't know how exactly what you mean there, but when I say painting animals, I mean drawings and paintings which give you the real sense of the animal. You feel you're looking at the animal and that it's a real thing. That's my general test of all art, whether it gives you a sense of reality.
Why did you go into mural painting?
Well, I don't know. I seem to, as long as I can remember, have had that more or less in my mind. When I was a very young boy, I was introduced to my first murals in Washington, D.C., when my father was congressman, and there were murals being painted even in the Congressional Library, and it fascinated me. So the impression was in my mind for a long, long time. And I think I kept it in mind, but I made no real efforts to do murals myself until about 1919, when I came back out of the Navy and had made up my mind, Navy in the First World War, made up my mind that I wasn't going to be just a studio painter, I was going to paint histories. And I don't know how it got back into me, I was going to paint histories of the United States, and I started in doing that. Just tentatively, I made some large canvases which when they were put together, made a mural 25 feet long. And I showed those at the Architectural League in New York. And they attracted a considerable amount of attention, controversy, and so forth. And eventually, I got a job at the New School for Social Research of painting a mural. And from that time on, I began getting other jobs. And that's the way it is.
You mentioned the realistic interpretation of the art. How do you feel in the artist expressing himself? Is it that he should express nature or express his own inner feelings or try to strike a balance?
Well, I don't think the artist can at any time help but expressing his own inner self. So I think the less attention he pays to that, the better off he is, because he can't help that anyhow. And it's been my general impression, my feeling, that the artist, particularly of our times, has not done himself a service by retiring into an artistic world of his own rather than staying in some contact with the public. Of course, it's not altogether the artist's fault. During the 19th century, the public had lost their interest in art, except as a highly specialized kind of profession. It lost its public usage. So the artist is not altogether to blame, but for retiring as he did. But it would be my feeling about things that if he can get out of this retirement and out into the actual world of men, that he's better off. Most people who spend their time looking into their interior self, we think they're in a pathological state. And I think that's might be said of many artists. I don't see any reason why the artist should have this close attention to his inner self, should have any more, be applauded for paying close attention to the inner self while we put people in the bug houses for doing, other people in the bug houses for doing that.
Tom, many of your paintings, your easel paintings, are based upon classical themes. Have you ever used this in any of your murals at all?
Well, now, I painted only 5 paintings with classical themes, and one of those is a mural. And it's in Kansas City here at the Hartsfeld store. That's kind of an allegory. Every one of these classical or Renaissance themes, you might call it. They were Renaissance themes because the Renaissance painters painted classical and biblical themes. And I've done, Susanna and the Elders out of the Apocrypha. And I've done Aeschylus and Hercules for the story here. I've done Persephone, which is a large easel painting. And the Golden Apple, the time when Paris gave Venus the Golden Apple, in spite of the fact that she didn't win the race in which she was supposed to win it. Well, that's all of them I've done.
Mm-hmm. One final question. In your opinion, how does the Truman Library mural compare to some of the other works that you have done?
You know, that question has been asked me before, and there's one thing that I don't do. I can't judge my own work. I don't even trust myself to judge other artists' work. I either I like it or I don't like it. I'm interested or I'm not interested.